Hey folks, I'm Scott Weingart, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, we are going to discuss a topic beyond the cutting edge. This is really future stuff. It's not applicable today. This is a discussion of a new therapy I think will really change the game for cardiac arrest. I'm joined by Jim Manning, an emergency physician who's been spending over two decades studying one particular therapy for medical and trauma arrest. And Dr. Manning is brilliant, and he has a lab where he's working on this stuff, and you're going to love to hear about it. I originally was going to put this up on the ED ECMO site because it really is right in with that stuff, but I figured all you would want to hear this as well. It's super important. Now, I know there are some listeners out there that don't like this future stuff. They want to know, what should I do now, not what's coming in the future. For you guys, on the next episode, I'm going to review exactly what I think we should be doing for sepsis in 2014, and so I think you'll be very happy. And so you got some future now, you got what to do today coming in 2 weeks, so hopefully that'll satisfy everyone. I will apologize. The sound on this interview is not up to its normal quality because I was on the road when I recorded it. So it's a little bit echoey. It's not great. And I had a cold. I still have a cold. It's been like 3 weeks. So with those provisos, hopefully you will enjoy the interview. I know I did. Now, I mentioned the ED ECMO site. Since I'm not putting this interview up there, what we did do is Joe and Zach went to Dr. Manning's lab in North Carolina and actually worked on his pigs doing this stuff. And they're going to have a whole bunch of stuff on the ED ECMO site to go along with this interview. So go over there as well and check it out. Enough with that. Let's get to Dr. Jim Manning on selective aortic arch perfusion. So why don't we get right into it? Why don't you tell the listeners who you are and what you do, Dr. Manning?
I'm an emergency physician at the University of North Carolina, and I split my time between doing clinical care, like most emergency physicians, and running a research lab. And the focus of the research lab is alt resuscitation and basically cardiac arrest, whether from medical causes or from trauma, hemorrhagic shock. So that's been the focus pretty much of my lab work for now nearly 25 years.
Very cool. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And in particular, I was very curious about the selective aortic arch perfusion. We just had an episode on REBOA, and I figured it would be a natural lead-in to talk to you about where you're going with the next level of blocking the aorta and now having access to the proximal aorta for all sorts of good stuff. And why don't we get right into that? What is selective aortic arch perfusion?
It's a technique where you use a balloon occlusion catheter to relatively select out the heart and the brain for perfusion during cardiac arrest. The idea came from when I was doing my resuscitation fellowship years ago, that I was looking at the mechanism of blood flow during CPR, and basically kind of came to the decision that that no matter what the mechanism of blood flow was, you still only got marginal blood flow generally during closed chest CPR. Whereas people like Peter Saffer and some other people in laboratories were looking at cardiopulmonary bypass at the time. It was right about the time when ECMO was just beginning to get its legs and make it into the clinical scene. And my thought was that is that non-invasive perfusion didn't seem to work all that well. Bypass worked extremely well. So I was trying to think of a technique that would be, so to speak, minimally invasive, although most people wouldn't think of aortic catheterization to be as being minimally invasive. But compared to, say, thoracotomy, minimally invasive, that would allow you to perfuse the heart and the brain as effectively as possible to get return of spontaneous circulation. And the thought there was that, well, if you could actually put a balloon catheter in the aorta, blow up the balloon, you can relatively select out the heart and the brain as much as you can quickly just to perfuse those until you can get the heart going again and hopefully keep the brain alive.
Why don't we take it step by step so people get an understanding of what you're actually talking about? So let's start with medical arrest first, just as you were elaborating on a second ago. So you get a patient in medical arrest. Someone starts closed chest CPR. You're going down to the groin, and what are you putting in there?
So the idea would be to put in an introducer first that would accommodate the balloon catheter. But to get arterial access, which is a key thing, because in cardiac arrest, getting arterial access is a little bit of a challenge because obviously you don't have normal pulses, and the pulses that you get with CPR are both in the artery and the vein. So it's a little bit of a trick. But once you get arterial access, the idea is then to float the balloon catheter blindly, I think this can be done blindly, up to the level of having the balloon above the diaphragm. Most anywhere between the left subclavian artery and the diaphragm, if you inflate the balloon there, the therapeutic effect is pretty much going to be the same. You're going to be perfusing the aortic arch vessels, which include the coronary arteries, and maybe a variable number of thoracic perforators, depending on exactly where the balloon is. But pretty much you get the same physiologic effect anywhere between the left subclavian artery and the diaphragm. And that's what allows it to, you've got some leeway in terms of the placement of this balloon catheter. So that's why I think it's possible to actually do this blindly.
Fair enough. And just for my own curiosity, what French is the current SAAP catheter you're working with?
The prototype we're working with right now has an internal diameter that's about 7.3 to 7.4 French, and that's the infusion lumen. And then the external diameter is right at about 11.3, 11.5 French. So the catheter we have right now could fit through a 14 French introducer with the balloon.
Fair enough. So a little bit bigger than the Kodacath we were talking about on the Reboa show a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly. Compared to the Reboa catheters the Kodacatheter that's already being used and the catheters that are under development, is that they are smaller because they don't need to have that central lumen for perfusion. We need, for the SAP catheter, you need to have a lumen that's large enough to be able to get pretty robust flow through it, at least sufficient for the perfusion of the heart and the brain. So yeah, it is a larger catheter.
Fair enough. Now, you're inflating the balloon to completely occlude the aorta. Do you have any tricks for that? That was the one point on the Reboa that I'm still think things can go wrong. How much do you inflate that balloon?
You know, probably the precise, what should be the precise target may not be, you know, we may not have it honed down exactly what that should be. What we're typically doing right now is inflating the balloon to a pressure of about 150 to 180 millimeters of mercury pressure. And our thought there is that that's a pressure that generally most any aorta can stand. It shouldn't cause rupture of the aorta, but it should get sufficient occlusion and hopefully prevent any migration of the catheter once you get return of circulation and you restore arterial pressure above the level of the balloon.
Very good. And you're doing that with just a pressure transduction manometry?
Yeah, exactly. We just have a three-way stopcock and we just blow it up and we blow it right up to say like 150, 160 millimeters of mercury and turn off the stopcock. We're there.
Perfect. Okay, so now if you did nothing else at this point, your CPR would probably be markedly more effective because you're perfusing a much smaller vasculature, and it's the vasculature you care about. Is that correct?
Potentially, because at that point, once you've blown up the balloon, you're doing the same thing that Reboa is. I mean, it's just the balloon occlusion. It's not really clear how effective that is in terms of like CPR. There are variable studies on it. It's been looked at in the past, actually, as far back as nearly 25 years ago, with variable results. Some suggest that there's some increase in coronary perfusion pressure. Others say there's minimal to no effect, no significant effect. So I'm not really clear how much the balloon occlusion alone, when you're trying to do CPR and generate a coronary perfusion pressure, how much does balloon occlusion alone help? My impression from the literature is that it's sort of variable from not much of any effect at all to maybe enough to be significant.
But you're not just stopping there. You're going forward because it's aortic arch perfusion. So in a medical arrest, what are you putting through this catheter?
Well, the key thing is for perfusion of the heart and the brain to get return of spontaneous circulation, what you want is some sort of oxygenated fluid. Now, originally when I started working on this, there are a whole host of companies that have been working on oxygen carriers or what some of them as blood substitutes. The two major categories being hemoglobin-based oxygen carriers and fluorocarbon-based oxygen carriers. And I really thought that when I started sort of tinkering with this some 25 years ago, that surely we were going to have like two or three of these out on the market within just a matter of a few years. Well, believe it or not, you know, of course, now 25 years later, we really still don't have one of these non-blood oxygen carriers that's out there readily available on the market. So I have studied over time both fluorocarbon oxygen carriers. They work well when oxygenated. I also studied hemoglobin-based oxygen carrier and cardiac arrest. It works very well likewise. So it just needs to be an oxygenated solution. If you look at what we presently have available right now, the only thing that's truly available at the moment is blood. So that's what our lab is actually focusing on right now. We're going with the one oxygen carrier that we do have access at present time to.
Fair enough. And now how much are you putting in and how quickly?
the infusion rate is actually pretty high. I mean, because we're trying to make sure that we close the aortic valve and get good perfusion of the heart and the brain. Typically, the rate at which we're perfusing is a rate of about 10 mils per kilogram per minute. So, you know, if that, that would be, say, for if you were looking at taking maybe like an average 70-75 kilogram person, we would be looking at probably infusing somewhere around 700 to 750 mils per minute into the aortic arch vasculature.
How are you getting the whatever you're using in at 750 cc's per minute?
Okay, yeah. At present, what we were using, we've been using infusion pumps, roller wheel infusion pumps, and we've actually been recently doing some work with centrifugal pumps. So a pump system is the appears to be the way probably to go with this, to have it sort of set up so that you can that you can you know program the pump so that as you begin the sap perfusion, you can set it up and just basically turn the machine on and have it run at the parameters that you want. And run at, say, a rate of 700, 800, 900, whatever it is that you need for, say, an individual patient or what you estimate would be needed.
Now, in that 70-kilo patient, 750 cc's a minute of blood, that would be about 3 units a minute, plus or minus. How much are you putting in total?
Well, there's the question. And this is where the use of selective aortic arch perfusion is a little different for medical cardiac arrest versus trauma arrest. In the medical cardiac arrest patient, you're probably talking about either a euvolemic or possibly a hypervolemic patient, for whom it's a volume loading procedure. So you're going to have some limitation in how long you can actually provide this support before you either get return of circulation or have to move on to some additional therapy. And so it looks like I think we could probably infuse for up to about 3 minutes. And it could be either a continuous infusion or some intermittent infusion, like perfusing for a minute, then off for 30 seconds doing CPR, then perfusing again for another minute. So you can probably stretch it out to somewhere up to maybe 3, maybe 5 minutes at the most in a medical cardiac arrest without hypovolemia before you begin to get into volume overload. Now, the thought we have on how to do this is you put in the sap catheter. You blow it up, you start to perfuse with whatever your exogenous oxygen carrier is, whether it's a fluorocarbon or a hemoglobin-based oxygen carrier or blood. And while you're doing that initial perfusion of the heart and the brain during the first 5 minutes, the next thing you do is try to get venous access, femoral venous access as well. And so that if you don't succeed in getting return of spontaneous circulation by the time you've sort of hit your volume limit, volume loading limit, then you begin to pull off blood, run it back through the circuit. Basically, it becomes limited body ECMO, and you can continue that as long as you want to until you get return of circulation.
And now you're not just stopping with the oxygenated carrier, whatever the type may be. You're actually infusing drugs in the medical arrest as well, and you're infusing them directly into the aortic arch. Can you talk about that for a little while, sir?
Yes, you can. One of the options that you have with this is that you have the ability to deliver pharmacologic agents directly to the heart and the brain. Now, this is really a largely untapped area in terms of what are the things that you could potentially put in that would either limit ischemic damage, limit reperfusion injury. There's a whole pharmacology that could potentially be applied using this sort of therapy. The thing that we have done up to now, since we've been focusing on trying to get return of spontaneous circulation, is we have given small doses of intra-aortic epinephrine to try to help improve the perfusion pressures, limit the perfusion as much as possible heart and brain, and get return of spontaneous circulation faster.
Fair enough. Now, it's interesting because we are not precisely sure, in fact, you probably know better than most, what the ideal dose or regimen of alpha agonists in cardiac arrest are. And we've always, at least for me, have thought about them as working on the arterioles and just increasing our peripheral resistance. But now we're taking out a whole bunch of the arterioles in the body. So what is your vision of how the epi is actually increasing coronary perfusion pressure? Is it just affecting the arterioles in the arms and actually just increasing yet again the amount of central blood volume? What do you think is actually going on here?
I think that's actually the case. I think what we're trying to do is because I think the epinephrine has a relatively minor effect on the coronaries and hopefully also on the brain. At least when you're talking to some pharmacologists who suggest that that you don't get as much sort of vasoconstriction of the brain because we're actually trying to preserve the brain. But the thing that's different about, say, for example, selective aortic arch perfusion, say, compared to coronary perfusion pressure when you're doing CPR, when you're doing CPR, you're trying to generate a perfusion gradient so that you get blood flow to the heart and brain. SAP is a little different in that you actually are taking over perfusion. So you're actually perfusing the heart and the brain. The question is, what pressure are you actually perfusing at? And so at least what we've done so far has shown that small doses of epinephrine intra-aortic along with the perfusion seems to improve the ability to get return of spontaneous circulation. So I think there's probably some vasoconstriction that you get, say, in the upper extremities or in the face and stuff, that probably helps still shunt blood flow to the heart and brain, and by generating just a higher pressure, maybe improves the perfusion to the heart and the brain. That's my impression of it, although teasing out that precisely physiologically is a little bit of a trick that we haven't really completely mastered.
So now you've given the perfusion, you've given maybe a smidgen of epinephrine to increase the coronary perfusion pressure, and how do the pigs in your lab come back when this works? Do they go into ventricular fibrillation and then you have to shock them out?
Well, actually, for the medical cardiac arrest, we actually put them in ventricular fibrillation. We model a V-fib cardiac arrest. So we will actually put them in V-fib with a pacing wire and then allow them to – we mimic basically an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest where nobody does CPR for 8 to 10 minutes. And then we'll do closed chest compressions for a couple of minutes just to get baseline CPR values and look and see what the coronary perfusion pressure is. Then we'll go ahead and begin to initiate the SAP infusion. And what we find is that what will happen is that you can imagine when you go into ventricular fibrillation, initially you have a real tight, real coarse V-fib. Over time, the V-fib wave pattern gets smaller, the amplitude and the frequency diminishes to where you get a more of a fine V-fib. When you begin to do the perfusion, you begin to reverse that process. You can watch the V-fib get progressively more coarse. And then over the span of about 2 to 3 minutes of perfusion, we then will begin to sequentially give defibrillation shocks until we're successful. And that may be as early as 1 to 2 minutes, or it may take 3 to 4 minutes. It's sort of, you know, individual variation, just as we see in humans. But that's what we do. We actually watch the V-fib pattern get perfusion and then shock them back into a perfusing rhythm. So we'll convert them, and then they generally immediately come right back with a viable pressure.
Now, where are we in terms of this being viable to start using on real patients right now? How far away are we from that?
Well, always further than I'd like to be, but I think it's been a slow process trying to get this technology sort of moved forward to where we can actually really think about using it clinically. I have the feeling that right now there are a number of things that are happening in medicine in terms of, you know, just all the advances in critical care, the advances in technology, catheter technology. You know, the Reboa coming along is an example of how we're getting more endovascular. That very idea of putting in aortic catheters is not at all foreign at this point. I mean, I can tell you when I first started talking about wanting to put a balloon catheter in people's aorta, you know, and perfuse the heart and brain during cardiac arrest, and I started talking about this 25 years ago, I mean, people literally looked at me kind of cross-eyed, like, what are you thinking? We're never going to do that. But now we're at a time where technology, so an acceptance of endovascular techniques and experience is all kind of coming together to say, yeah, this is, you know, more people look at me and say, yeah, this kind of makes sense. Yeah, we ought to be able to do this. So I don't know exactly how long, but I'm hoping somewhere in the next couple of years, we're seriously talking about trying to put together and do a clinical trial and get it.
I'm super excited about that. You know, I first read your work from the Annals in the 90s. And so this has been a long time in development. So it would be great to see the first human trial. I'd be very happy to read that in a major journal in the coming months and years.
Yeah, I've been sort of stubborn about it, mainly because I could tell from the early work that I did, even back in the 1990s, that this really worked. The perfusion level that you get to the heart and brain, well, if you look just like specifically at heart perfusion, I mean, how well does this work? You actually, CPR generally, if done well and done early, generates maybe 25 to 30% of normal blood flow. Selective aortic arch perfusion can generate greater than 100%. You can get greater flow than you can get during normal sinus rhythm. And that seems to be like, well, how can that be? And the reason is because the heart's not beating, so you can perfuse it continuously, not just during the diastolic phase of the cardiac cycle. So you can really get robust perfusion of the heart, and I think that's why it works so well.
Fantastic. Let's move to trauma. What's the application of SAAP for trauma patients?
Well, interestingly, I came up with the idea and started working on it for a number of years for medical cardiac arrest, recognizing the limitation of volume overload. And then as I was working on it, I was just a few years into it, I started scratching my head saying, you know, this is really, I mean, I developed it for medical cardiac arrest, but it's really more made to order for trauma cardiac arrest, because the balloon acts as a functional aortic cross clamp. So instead of doing a thoracotomy and internal massage and cross clamping the aorta and having a huge thoracotomy scar and all the damage that potentially goes with that, I mean, here's a case where you can put in the balloon catheter, blow up the balloon, there's your aortic cross clamp, and then you can perfuse into the heart and the brain. But the other thing is you've got a hypovolemic patient that needs volume resuscitation. This is a rapid way to get volume repletion while you're also perfusing the heart and brain. So it just became sort of evident that, you know, we should start playing around with this in a trauma cardiac arrest model. And so we started doing liver laceration, exsanguination modeling, and lo and behold, it works quite well for that.
That makes complete sense, and I think it is, especially for the blunt traumatic arrest that code in front of you, a brilliant solution. Reboa is good. This sounds like the next iteration of Reboa for patients like this. But then we can extend it even further. Let's talk a little bit about EPR.
Yeah, well, sort of the whole broad idea of this is, as I've talked with the proponents of Reboa, and I'm a fan of Reboa. I mean, I don't think of myself as being in competition with the people that are the vascular surgeons, the military surgeons who are working on Reboa, because I think there's clearly a place for Reboa. I sort of think of this as another step in a whole series of potential interventions, escalating interventions that we can use for patients on an as-needed basis. Patients who need Reboa alone, great. If Reboa is not working, it may be that something like selective aortic arch perfusion may be the next step. It gives you the same balloon occlusion, but it also gives you the ability to perfuse. If, however, that is unsuccessful, if you're unable to get return of spontaneous circulation, if you're not able to get the patient to stabilize, then the next thing you can think about in a patient that's where you think you have the ability to salvage them is to go to profound hypothermia and initiate EPR or suspended animation, as Peter Saffer originally called it. And one of the ways to do that, actually, Saffer originally, their original studies, they were using an aortic balloon catheter to perform suspended animation. And it's evolved now into whole body EPR, you know, this emergency preservation resuscitation that's being pushed by in a multi-center study now, and Sam Tishman out of Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a way to actually potentially you could use the sap catheter to at least initiate the process of EPR. Eventually, you got to do the whole body, but it may be a way to initiate it and get things going and get the heart and brain first.
Now, in terms of the clinical work currently published, you put a paper in Journal of Trauma saying it is feasible in a out-of-hospital cardiac arrest to get a catheter up there. And I think that's step one, is to say this is doable. What is coming out next in terms of progressing this to actually making this a viable option for patients in the field?
Yeah, I think I did that in medical cardiac arrest patients and went out into the field I didn't have a balloon catheter, but I put in pressure catheters so that I could measure coronary perfusion pressure and adjust therapy in the field right there where they arrested. And had some success with that, at least in terms of getting return of spontaneous circulation, and did find that in most cases, relatively quickly, in under 5 minutes, I could get arterial access and get a catheter in place and place it blindly, effectively, without it, you know, having it in good position, just based on landmarks. So I think that supports the idea that, yes, once you get femoral arterial access, you can actually place one of these catheters blindly. You don't have to have an X-ray or imaging or something, C-arm to sort it out. So that means that you could potentially do this in the field. So, I mean, that, now, if you look now at what's happening with Reboa, there's a push toward trying to do this in the field. Amazingly, I mean, you may know this already, but the London Helicopter EMS system has got it set up where I think in March they went live with the capability of doing Reboa in the field with their helicopter EMS, the physicians that fly there. It's, you know, Gareth Davies, and who's the medical director for the London Helicopter EMS, and Karen Brohe, who's the chief trauma surgeon for Royal London Hospital. I mean, those guys are in sync on this, and they've pushed it from the ER out into the field. And I'm just kind of waiting to hear from Gareth Davies about, okay, when was your first patient?
Absolutely. Super exciting.
Yeah, so I think the next thing is just once we've shown that, yeah, if you can place a pressure catheter blindly, then you can place a balloon catheter blindly. next thing is just putting in a sap catheter, and you know, we keep escalating the level of care as we demonstrate that we're capable of doing it.
Now, I'll ask you one last question, sir, and then I'll let you get back to your day, because this is a area that I know Joe, Zach, and I all agree on, though the evidence isn't great. But Safford spoke about using our alpha agonist to increase coronary perfusion pressure, even without the SAAP catheter. And so for me, I'm dosing my epinephrine based on my A-line. That's not in the aortic arch, unfortunately, but A-line diastolic pressure. I usually don't throw in a CVP line, so I don't have a central venous pressure, but I'm just going a little bit higher on my goal. I just shoot for a diastolic of 40, and that's when I dose my epi. Does this correlate with what you're doing in the lab?
Yeah, I mean that's a reasonable thing to aim for. I think if you just got an A line and you're dosing your epinephrine based on the A line, you would like to see your CPR diastolic arterial pressure at least get to 30. Anywhere above 30, the higher you can go, the better. And I think 40 is a very reasonable sort of target. You're aiming to try, you know, not just maybe stopping at 30, but trying to ratchet up a little bit more. So I'm just guessing. Can I ask you a question? Is your A line in the radial artery?
I always go femoral.
Femoral. Okay. Well, my suggestion would be is if you're going to put in a femoral A line, one of the things you could consider doing is slipping in a little bit longer catheter, get it all the way up to the aorta. You can do your pressure measurement. Plus, you can also the thing about titrating in intra-aortic epinephrine, and this is one of the things I did in one of my studies in the early 1990s, was showed that it was superior to central venous epinephrine. And what you can do is when you push in a dose of intra-aortic epinephrine, especially if you dilute it up, like in 50 cc's, and just blast it in real quick, you've got your maximal vasoconstrictor effect in about 30 to 50 seconds. You know exactly what your maximal effect's going to be. So what you can do is you can use small doses. When I went in the field and was using intra-aortic epinephrine, I would start with quarter milligram or maybe half milligram doses at most, just because I knew that I would know in about 30 seconds or so if I needed to give more. And then that way you can titrate the amount of epinephrine you need just to the effect that you want without overdosing it. And unfortunately, I think that's one of the problems with giving intravenous epinephrine is we slowly circulate a small amount of it to where we get a therapeutic effect. Then if we get return of circulation, especially with high dose epinephrine, you then effectively mobilize an overdose of epinephrine. And if you're titrating in an intra-arterial, you can do it in such a way so that you don't overdose it. You just get the amount of epinephrine or whatever adrenaline, get just the amount that you need to get the physiologic effect, and that's it.
That's fantastic. I think we could stop there unless you have anything else you want to share with the listeners.
No, other than just I'm excited about what I'm also excited to see how ECMO is being pushed forward. I mean, I'll just plug that, you know, if you look at what I think Joe Bledsoe and Zach Shiner are just out there on the forefront looking at using ECMO in cardiac arrest. And for the medical side of this, I mean, I think SAP is like an initial therapy that then can transition into partial body or partial ECMO, or what I've had called autologous blood SAP, all the way to full body ECMO once you get them to the emergency department, so that you can then, you've got them stabilized. If you can't get return spontaneous circulation with one of these therapies, at least you've got them perfusing well enough that you can then go to the cath lab, the OR, whatever it is that you think you can do to actually help salvage your patient. So I think what they're doing is fantastic. And I see all of these as sort of Venn diagrams that all overlap.
Well, there you go. Come on over to the MCRIT site. Check out the show notes for this episode. My name is Scott Weingart. This was the MCRIT podcast. And I am saying bye-bye.